this evening, Swami Vatthakumayananda is going to give a talk on the introduction to the Hindu scriptures. And Swami Vatthakumayananda is very well qualified. He has been a scholar of Sanskrit and scriptures, I think, since childhood. He was an acharya at our training center in Ramakrishna Dharma for some time. He's also worked in various centers of the Ramakrishna Mission in India as editor and teacher of Sanskrit and Indian philosophy. Very well qualified. We had him, he gave us a retreat at Ganges last year, and it was one of our most popular retreats. Everybody really liked it and wanted us to have him back. So we're very happy to have Swami Vatthakumayananda with us. At present, he is the assistant minister of the Vedanta Society of Northern California in San Francisco. So I invite Swami to speak.
युवंदप्रवेश्यमवाच मीमां संजीवयति अखिलशक्तिधरस्वधाम्ना अन्यांश्च हस्तचरणश्रवणत्वकारी प्राणान् नमो भगवते पुरुषाय बो डाउन टू दि इमिनेंट दि ओमनिप्रेजेंट ट्रांसेंडेंट रियलिटी दैट इज एन एचाइसर एंड इंटुअल इन ऑल बीइंग्स इन दिस क्रिएशन ओम पीस पीस पीस. Now, my topic here is a general introduction to Hindu religious and spiritual literature, maybe with some reference to Bhagavata Purana, which I am going to deal with in detail in three sessions tomorrow. Now, many of you who are not familiar with the Hindu philosophical literature will be astounded if I tell you that the earliest of Hindu religious and philosophical scripture dates back from the 4th millennium BC. So even according to the least orthodox estimates, Rigveda Samhita, which is the most ancient and the most fundamental among the Hindu religious scriptures, belongs to 4300 BC. Of course, according to traditional orthodox scholars, it dates back still earlier, maybe 7000 BC. Of course, it's a different matter. It has been translated, at least some portions of this ancient work has been translated by MacDonald and several Keith, Vindanids and several other Western Orientalists and also Indian scholars. Okay, now the most fundamental among the canonical works of Hindu tradition are the four Vedas: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, Atharveda, of which Rigveda is the most ancient and the most traditional and the most fundamental, which is called Shruti. Shruti means the philosophical literature which contains ideas and teachings which are relevant for all times, all ages, and for the entire humanity. It's not with any special reference to a particular geographical region or a group of people professing any particular religious faith system or a particular culture. It is universal in its scope, application, and its philosophical teachings. It is called, technically it is called Shruti. Shruyate dharma anaya iti Shruti. The fundamental scriptures which teach us how to live in this world. How to practice life in this world without forgetting the fundamental spiritual teachings. That's the definition of Shruti, the most fundamental scriptures. The second in this category comes Smriti, which are more or less like constitutions of law, books of laws, like the 10 books of law by given to Moses, you know, something like that. Or maybe the first 5 books of the Jewish canon, something like that, which contains do's and don'ts, ideas, injunctions and teachings which regulate our conduct in this world. what we must do, what we must not do, which are not of universal dimension, which have no universal application. They change from time to time, and they sometimes they are very lopsided, sometimes they are divisive, and they are relevant only to a particular time, to a particular context, or to a particular cultural tradition. It is called smriti. That's the second category. The first is Shruti or the Vedas, which contain the fundamental principles of life in this world and also some of the deepest metaphysical and spiritual questions as to what is the fundamental goal of human existence, what's the purpose of human life, why are we here. There are some people who can stand away from the instinctive flow of evolution and stop for some time, pause and ask the question, why am I here? How am I different from the members of the animal kingdom? What is the line of demarcation between human beings and the animal kingdom? Such fundamental ideas, spiritual, universal ideas are contained in the Vedas or Shruti, and at the same time, the next in importance and relevance comes Smriti, which are just books of law, which are not of universal application, which are not relevant for all times and all ages, which are relevant and important only to the contemporary times and maybe to people belonging to particular cultural tradition. The third category is Puranas, which are more or less mythological books. You find a lot of exaggerations. These are all more or less, well, those of you are familiar with Homer's Odyssey or Iliad will be able to understand, get an idea of what is meant by Puranas, mythological books. Highly exaggerated stories, statements, ideas, allegories, tales of emperors, kingdoms, saints and sages and so on, but they also contain certain fundamental spiritual ideas, but they are not expressed directly. They are expressed in the language of stories, allegories, figures of speech and metaphors, which is called Puranas. Now, the most distinguishing aspect of Hindu canonical tradition is this, and that is something very important. In fact, Swami Vivekananda has referred to this particular aspect again and again. Swamiji says, whenever there is a conflict between the teachings of the secondary literature, like the books of law, Smriti or Puranas, and the teachings of the Vedas or Shruti, then you should discard the views of the secondary literature. For example, some books tell you that people should behave in a particular manner in a particular time, or there are certain rules and laws and do's and don'ts which are important to a particular age or a particular class of people living in a country or a geographical region, which are not of universal relevance. So whenever there's a conflict between the secondary canonical literature and the fundamental Vedic literature, then we must discard the teachings of the secondary religious books. Say some books will tell you, may teach you certain things, ideas which are relevant to the particular time in which that book was written. See, this you find in the Old Testament, in New Testament, and most of the religious scriptures of the three Abrahamic religions, and also Hindu mythological books, you find such ideas, which are not of universal application, which have a relevance only to that particular age in which they were written. Now, Swamiji emphasized again and again that whenever there's a conflict between the teachings of the secondary literature and the teachings of the fundamental spiritual universal literature, we must discard the teachings and ideas of the secondary literature, and we must uphold the universal teachings of the Vedas and Shrutis. I can give an example. The Vedas tell you that spirituality is essentially a man of a matter of our intuitive inner experience. It is not a matter of faith system. It is not something that you believe in. It is something that you experience and translate into our everyday life. So spirituality is a matter of inner experience, inner evolution. As Swami Vivekananda said, the manifestation of divinity already in man. In fact, these ideas are stated in the Vedas and Sutras. On the other hand, if you go to books of law, you find many ideas which will tell you, well, certain class of people have no right to do worship in a temple or a place of worship. Certain people have no right to read sacred scriptures. Such divisive ideas. Such ideas. No, according to our tradition, whenever there is a conflict between the universal and the secondary, the parochial, the nationalistic, then we must discard the parochial and nationalistic ideas and we must accept and uphold the universal spiritual ideas which are relevant for all times. In fact, one of the great writers of law book called, you know, Jabala was a great sage. He said, Shruti smriti virodheshu shrutireva gariyasi avirodhetu sadakaryam smartam vaidhikavarsada. The Jabala Smriti says that whenever there's a conflict between the books of law and the books of fundamental spiritual ideas, then the books of law should be discarded because books of law are relevant only to the particular age and to the particular people for whom those do's and don'ts, those laws are prescribed. But spiritual laws are relevant and important and it is applicable to the entire humanity of all times and all ages, all countries. In fact, spirituality doesn't recognize the barriers of geographical, cultural, or nationalistic differentiation. It doesn't recognize the national, the lines of demarcation between nation and nation, culture and culture, and one faith system with another faith system. Now, another smriti says, Shruti smriti virodheshu shrutireva gariyasi avirodhetu sadakaryam smartam vaidhika vasada. The Shruti smriti purananam virodho yatra drishyate tatra shraudam pramanam syat tayodvaithe smriti vara. I'm just trying to give an idea of this in modern language and with some reference to the fundamental scripture and sayings in which these ideas are stated. Vyasa was the author of Bhagavata Purana, which we are going to discuss tomorrow. Vyasa also wrote a great smriti, a book of law, in which he said the fundamental books of Hindu tradition are three in number, the smriti or the Vedas, the smriti of the books of law, and the Puranas, which are all mythological books. Now he says, whenever there is a conflict between the fundamental spiritual ideas of Vedas or Shruti and the secondary details, secondary teachings enshrined in the books of law called the Smritis, we must discard the teachings of Smriti and we must uphold and consider to be authentic the teachings of the Vedas. And again he says, whenever there is a conflict between the teachings of the books of law, that is Smritis and Puranas, we must discard the teachings of Puranas or mythological books and uphold the teachings of laws of books of law. Now, this is, I'm just giving an example. So, the fundamental books of Hinduism are divided into three categories. The first and the most authentic and the most universal and which are as relevant today in the 21st century as they were relevant 7,000 years back. They are the Vedas, the Shrutis, which contain the fundamental spiritual and philosophical questions related to human existence. The fundamental ontological questions about the origin of the world, the nature of God, the nature of the absolute reality, and the fundamental goal of human existence, the fundamental ethical ideas, all these are contained in the Vedas, which are the most authentic among the canonical works of Hindu philosophical and spiritual tradition. The second, the books of law, which more or less correspond to the Mosaic books of law of the ancient Jewish tradition. And the third in importance is Puranas. Puranas are mythological books. In fact, tomorrow I am going to deal with one of the Puranas, Bhagavata Purana. Now, Bhagavata Purana has got a special importance because Bhagavata Purana contains a lot of mythological stories. You can read about kings and emperors living for thousands of years, sages meditating in the forest hermitages for 36,000 years. Now, these are all mythological stories, allegories, metaphors. But then behind these stories, there is a greater story, the fundamental spiritual truths for which these stories and mythological ideas play the role of just medium. Means these great spiritual ideas are expressed in the language of allegories and metaphors and mythological stories. But more than that, Bhagavata Purana addresses some of the most vital and fundamental questions of human existence. That's why it is so very important. So the purpose of my reference to Bhagavata Purana is, it has got a special importance because I will tell you something about the author. Vyasa is the author. He was the one who edited the entire Vedic literature into four categories. It is said that in ancient times, Vedas were one whole. Vyasa did not classify, but he edited these Vedas into four categories: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, and Atharveda. Rigveda he taught to one of his disciples. He is known as Paila. Yajurveda he taught to Vaishambhayana, another sage, another disciple. And Samaveda he taught to Jaimini, a third disciple. And Atharveda he taught to Sumantu, another disciple. So the Vedic literature was one whole, in fact. People like great Western Orientalists like Max Muller, Vindernitz, Keith, MacDonald, Paul Dusen, and they were astounded when accidentally their destiny got them connected to Vedic literature. Max Muller really was not a great lover of the Vedas to begin with. His purpose was something different. But as he started studying the Vedas, as he started his efforts to publish Rigveda literature, he became a convert to Vedic culture. Because Vedas do not teach you to believe in a particular kind of religious tradition. It teaches you ultimately to believe in the existence of a universal cosmic spirit which is immanent in all of us and which is also omnipresent, all-pervading, and which is also transcendental. That was why great scholars like Max Muller was so much impressed. They were completely converted into great fans and devotees of Vedic culture and Vedic tradition. Now, in Bhagavata Purana, as I said earlier, Vyasa deals with one fundamental vital question. What are the spiritual truths, spiritual laws that we must practice? Books give you different rules and regulations. See, Mahabharata deals with dharma. Dharma is somewhat neutral. See, every person can have his own dharma, his own idea of good conduct. Even a criminal, if he gets a good attorney, can get his case defended effectively, and he can come out scot-free. So every person can have his own idea of good conduct. But Vyasa addresses the question of what should a man or woman living in this world do to practice spirituality? How can he or she realize his supreme spiritual goal? how he should practice spirituality in day-to-day activities. That's called Bhagavata Dharma. Not real Dharma, the fundamental spiritual truths which Lord Krishna himself taught in his life, through his life and teachings. That in fact they constitute the essence of Bhagavata Purana, which I am going to deal with tomorrow. Now, the next in importance comes the great classical books, which many of you must have heard, Ramayana and Mahabharata. They are semi-historical. They are not fully historical, you know. Mahabharata contains no less than 100,000 verses. In fact, the smallest version of Mahabharata contains about 100,000 verses. There are three important versions, and the largest version contains 145,000 verses. Now, the smallest version is almost 11 times the size of Homer's Iliad, Odyssey, and Virgil's Aeneid put together. Homer's Greek classics, you know, Odyssey and Iliad, which incidentally has many similarities with Mahabharata, so far as story goes. And Virgil's Aeneid put together, if you multiply this by 11, that is the size of Mahabharata. And in fact, one of the most fundamental Hindu classics, which many of you must have read, many of you may be chanting every day, Bhagavad Gita, which contains 700 verses. And in fact, it is a very tiny portion of Mahabharata, which contains, as I said, in its smallest version, more than 100,000 verses. Bhagavad Gita is perhaps one of the most important scriptures of Hindu canonical tradition. That's because Bhagavad Gita contains, though it's a part of a classical book like Mahabharata, it contains all the teachings of the Vedas. All the teachings which are contained, which are enshrined in the Upanishads, and also in the philosophical and spiritual portions of the Vedic literature, are compressed in a short form, and that is Bhagavad Gita, which contains 700 verses divided into 18 chapters in the form of a dialogue between a great man of God known as Sri Krishna and his friend and disciple Arjuna, who was a soldier. Now, so there are, first of all, there are four Vedas: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda and Atharvaveda. And each of these Vedas has got four divisions, subdivisions we may call. A portion, that part of the Vedas which contains the hymns sung in praise of great gods and goddesses. In this Vedic literature you find a very interesting aspect for any student of philosophy and religion. All the various aspects of divinity are described in the Vedic literature. We have got pantheism, panitheism, monotheism, henotheism, monism and absolute monism. These are the 5-6 levels of evolution of Godhead in world literature. Pantheism equates nature with God. Panitheism recognizes an immanent reality behind the natural phenomena. Monotheism conceives God as one supreme creator of the entire universe, who is the one who creates this world, who sustains it, and who ultimately dissolves this universe. That's a monotheistic concept of God. Henotheism implies the concept of a supreme God in each context. So if there is one hymn addressed to one of the deities, then that deity becomes supreme. But in another hymn addressed to another godhead, that godhead becomes supreme. It is called henotheism, sometimes it's called. It's opportunistic monotheism, that is the term which Max Müller coined. Max Müller was the one who, with his background of Western linguistic and philosophical research, analyzed this evolution of godhead and absolute reality in the Vedic literature. And then we have this monism, the idea of a God who is beyond, who transcends a form, a name, attributes, etc. A monistic God doesn't deny the existence of attributes, names and forms, but goes beyond the concept of a God who creates this world and divides mankind into conflicting groups of believers and non-believers, promising heaven to believers and threatening non-believers with eternal damnation. Because he conceives of a God who is a cosmic supreme consciousness which is beyond names and forms and verbalization, which can only be experienced as an immanent reality within, and which is also omnipresent, all-pervading and transcendental. So all these ideas of Godhead could be found in Vedic literature. That's something very interesting. So if you read the Vedas, you will find practically all possible human concepts of absolute reality, Godhead, are referred to in the Vedic literature. But behind all this plurality or duality of Godheads or concepts of God, Vedas proclaim that there is a unifying thread of unity of one reality. So Indram Mitram Varunam Agni Rahu Adho Divyasa Suparna Virutman Ekam Sat Vipra Bhudha Vadandi Agni Yama Matarishwanamahu. Rigveda has got 10 mandalas. In the first mandala, there is one Risupta. The Sukta says all these Indra Mitra, all these different names of Godheads mentioned in Vedic literature. These are all different names which enlightened people use to call the one reality, which in fact is the one supreme all-pervading reality. This is the structure of the Vedic literature. Now, and as I said earlier, this Vedic literature contains that portion which deals with the hymns in praise of gods and goddesses, and that portion deals with rituals, the detailed observation of different rituals called Brahmanas. First it's called Samhita, Brahmana, then Aranyakas. Aranyakas contain certain hymns in praise of different deities, gods, who should be praised by people during their retirement period. In the Manusmriti, which gives a detailed analysis of the Vedic scheme of life, there is one verse which says, Grihastasya yada pasyet bali palidam atmanaha apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasyet. This is a very interesting verse. It says, an householder, when he finds his hair is getting grey, or face is wrinkled, or when he sees the face of his grandson, should take to forest, go to a forest and live in a hermitage. The rest of his lifetime he should spend in meditation, in contemplation and prayer. That says. In fact, it contains many of the hymns to be chanted by people during their retirement period. And the last portion is Upanishads. These Upanishads are actually the essence of Hindu philosophical spiritual literature. When I use the word the Shruti or the Vedas, what we actually mean is the essence of Vedas, means Vedanta. Veda means Vedanam Anta. Anta means last, final word, the conclusion. It also means the inner essence, the gist. So Vedanta actually means Upanishads. Vedanam Anta or Vedasya Anta means the last, final word or conclusion, the conclusive statement of the Vedic literature, or the inner essence. Anta means within, the essence. Now, Vedanta actually means Upanishads. It is this Upanishadic portion of the Vedas which actually asks the question, why am I here? What's the purpose of my life? How should I lead my life in a way which is good for me and also good for the world? All these fundamental ideas of life, spiritual ideas, philosophical ideas, are depicted in the Upanishad literature. Upanishads are altogether around 240. Right now, we know of 240 Upanishads. But all these 240 Upanishads are not available in the original Sanskrit form. Around 180 Upanishads are available. And of these 180, 10 Upanishads are the most important of the Upanishad literature, Vedic literature. Because they were commented upon by Shankaracharya. They were expounded by the great Shankaracharya, the greatest exponent of Vedanta tradition, who lived in 8th century, was born in 788 AD and passed away in 820, 32 years. So he was the one who expounded the entire Vedic philosophy and made it into a compact philosophical superstructure which is known today as Vedanta. Isha, Kena, Katha, Prashna, Mundaka, Mandukya, Taittiriya, Aitireya, Chandogya and Brihadaranyaka. These are the 10 Upanishads which he commented upon, on which he wrote commentaries, which constitute the fundamental philosophical tradition of Vedanta, Vedantic heritage. Now, as I said, after this Smritis, so books of law, then we have got these Puranas which contain many ideas which are purely literary, which are just allegorical, which are just metaphors, we do not have any historical background. Now, we have two fundamental classics which most of you read, that is Mahabharata, at least the fraction of Mahabharata which is known as Bhagavad Gita, and also Ramayana. These two great classics have got a special importance in Hindu canonical tradition. One important characteristic of these two classics is they contain both imagination and also history. See, Rama was a historical figure, more or less it is proved nowadays. But the stories contain, the stories in which Rama's life is expounded or described in Ramayana may not be historically true 100%. There could be a lot of exaggeration. But there is no doubt that a great spiritual personality like Rama lived in this world. Now Mahabharata again. In Mahabharata also the story of Sri Krishna, who is one of the greatest teachers of Vedantic tradition in Hindu spiritual heritage. So they contain both the literary and also the historical aspects of religious tradition. They contain many cultural, many social, and many things related to how we must live a proper life in this world. Now I can give you a rough idea of the Hindu view of life, Hindu scheme of life expounded in the Vedic tradition. There is a convocation address in the Taittiriya Upanishad comes where a boy who has completed his education in the hermitage is about to go back to his home. In ancient times, children used to be sent to forest hermitages for education in Vedic law and Vedic way of conduct, how to become a responsible member of the family, a law-abiding citizen of the nation, and how to become a useful member of society. So there used to be an elaborate scheme of education and upbringing during the Vedic times. So there is a convocation address. It begins like this: Vedam anuchi acharya andevasanam anushasti satyam vada dharmam chara satyana pramadidavyam dharmana pramadidavyam. These are some of the teachings in the which are found in the entire Vedic literature. So after teaching the Vedas, the teacher gives an instruction to his disciple. So instruction: you should speak the truth and you should never deviate from the truth. and you should practice righteousness. You should never deviate from the path of righteousness. And then of course, there is a series of four important instructions which are maybe more relevant today than maybe those days. Matrudevo bhava, pitrudevo bhava, acharyadevo bhava, adithidevo bhava. Fundamental teachings. You should respect your mother, your father, your guest and your teacher as much as you revere God himself. This in essence is a teaching. Now, you can just imagine the Vedic scheme of life. First, the fundamental ethical teachings are given. You should speak the truth and you should never deviate from the path of truth. You should practice righteousness and you should never deviate from the path of righteousness. And then, a very important lesson which is closely related to family life. You should be respectful to your parents, to your guest, and also to your teacher. Now, in the Vedic tradition, in the Vedic heritage, the most respectable and the most important figure in domestic life was mother. Manusmriti says, there is a Upadhyaya Sadacharya Acharya to Shadam Pida. Then you see, Sagasrena Adhigam Madhu Gauravena Adirichyate. There is a famous verse in Manusmriti. These Smritis, these lawgivers, give detailed instructions as to how you must practice Vedic scheme of life. So, Upadhyaya Satacharya. Upadhyaya is a person who teaches one particular branch of Veda, or maybe chemistry or physics, whatever may be. Not the whole literature. So, you should respect your teacher who teaches you something. And you should respect a professor who teaches you one entire Veda, one whole branch of Veda. And the respect given to the professor or the teacher who teaches you, to takes you through the whole Vedic scheme of life is 10 times the respect you give to somebody who teaches you one aspect of Vedic literature. So, Vadhyaya Dishacharya, then Acharya to Shatam Pita. And you should respect, your respect for your father should be 100 times the respect you give to your professor. Because father teaches you something which a professor can never teach you in a university. Father teaches you not only information, but he gives you the culture which enables you to make proper use of the knowledge and wisdom and power that you get through your education. So the respect given to father should be 100 times the respect given to the professor. Then the second line says, Sahasrena adhigam matuhu gauravena atirichyate. Your respect for your mother should be 1,000 times the respect that you give to your father. Because it is mother who actually takes you by your hand when you are an infant and teaches you the fundamental aspects of life in this world. From mother you don't learn, you imbibe. It's also from father also. So, that's why the first instruction given by a teacher who completes his education, to a disciple who completes his education and who is about to go back to his home to start the life of an household. The first instruction given to a boy who is going to marry and become a full-fledged member of society is Matrudevo. You should respect your mother as much as you respect God himself. It doesn't mean that you should worship her or set up a temple and put an image and worship. No, that's not the idea. The idea is you respect your mother is an integral part of your own life. That's the idea. Now you can see Rama's respect for his parents and all the great teachers, spiritual teachers, prophets in their life have taught us how to lead a happy life in this world by combining spirituality and secular values. A synthesis of the best of the spiritual and the best of the secular. Second instruction is Pitrudevo Bhava. You should respect your father also. And then Acharya Devo Bhava. Because your ability to make use of the learning that you get from your teacher is in direct proportion to the respect that you have given to that teacher who taught you in the classroom. Otherwise, you know, sometimes we may learn a lot, we may not remember on the right moment. Or we may put the wrong idea at the right moment. So very often it happens. So to be able to make proper use of what we learn from a teacher, we must get the blessing of the teacher. Therefore, you should respect the teacher also as much as you respect father. So, Matrudevo Bhava, Pitrudevo Bhava, Acharyadevo Bhava, Adithidevo Bhava. Adithi means a guest. Not that Adithi really means anamantritaha agataha adithaya. Somebody who comes without information before that. Anamantritaha agataha. Somebody suddenly knocks at your door in your home and at night without giving prior information, who is in need of shelter and food. You should treat him properly. These fundamental principles of charity are taught to boys who complete their education and who are about to go back to their homes to start the life of an household. So all these ideas are enshrined in the Vedic literature. But these teachings were later codified and they were classified and expounded by the great lawgivers who taught us to practice this depending upon the times and also the culture. Now, one fundamental difference between the teachings of the Upanishads or the Vedas and the teachings of the books of law is this. The teachings of the books of law continue changing. They're subject to changes. What Manu wrote maybe 3,000 years back or 2,000 years back may not be relevant, as relevant today as it was when he wrote it 2,000 years back. Because times have changed, society has changed, human life has changed. So the rules and regulations and instructions given in the law books or smritis are subject to change. And again, they may not be as relevant to people living in this country as they were relevant maybe to people who lived in India 2000 years back. So they are subject to change in terms of place, culture, tradition and also time. But the teachings of the Upanishads, they are eternal, eternal spiritual universal laws, because they address the fundamental vital spiritual questions of mankind. What is the purpose of human life? What is the origin of the universe? What is the final destination of human existence? All these ideas are dealt with in this literature. Now, in great literary classics like Ramayana and Mahabharata, the authors, Valmiki in Ramayana and Vyasa in Mahabharata, have given detailed descriptions of great spiritual personalities who actually practiced these great spiritual truths in their life. Rama in Ramayana and Sri Krishna in Mahabharata are two classical examples. In Mahabharata there are many other great characters like Bhishma, Drona, Vidura, Kripacharya and large number of great teachers, great warriors, great administrators. They're all their life and their teachings and the way they conducted their life are explained in the Mahabharata. There are long dialogues between Bhishma and Yudhishthira and long dialogues between Bhishma and Sri Krishna. All these are found in the Mahabharata literature. And the Ramayana you find, Rama's story is itself is in its essence, it is as relevant today as it was during those days. It doesn't mean that you can fly from Sri Lanka to Himalayas. It is not possible. So these are fundamental. These are all allegories and metaphors and imaginations of exaggerations. But the fundamental spiritual truths with Rama practiced in his life, which other brothers like Bharata, Lakshmana, Shatrughna and Hanuman, other characters practiced and expounded in their life, they are as vital, as relevant today as they were, to say, 3,000 or 4,000 years back. But behind all this, there is one truth. For householders, the best way to practice spirituality is by combining right conduct, which they call dharma, and spirituality. And for sannyasins, the best way to achieve the spiritual goal is to realize the supreme truth within, and also to experience the presence of this immanent truth in the entire universe. In fact, this is the one essence of our spiritual literature. As we realize the supreme truth within, we also realize the same truth is the omnipresent, all-pervading reality outside. So on the one hand, we reach closer to God in spiritual life when we realize our own true nature. On the other hand, we better more broad-minded, more compassionate, more universal in our outlook towards other human beings in this world. So in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a verse in the fourth chapter where Lord Krishna expounds this philosophy of combining action and contemplation, where he expounds the life ideal of a Rajarshi in the fourth chapter. Ibam Vivasade Yogam Proptavanaham Avyam Vivaswan Manave Praha Manu Ikshagavya Bravi Evam Parambara Praptam Imam Rajashriyo Vidhu Sakalena Iha Mahada Yogo Nashta Parantava. Where Sri Krishna says, in ancient times, in Vedic times, great emperors, philosophers and spiritual teachers used to practice this yoga, used to expound this yoga, and he calls them Rajashi, means a person who is as dynamic as a king, at the same time as saintly as a saint. He has got the contemplative attitude of a saint, but has got the efficiency of a king. Confucius said, you know, sagely within, kingly without. Combination of efficiency and also tranquility within. Now, the whole Mahabharata and Ramayana is full of great characters who are role models in combining the secular and the spiritual values in their life. Dilipa and Rishabha, Jatabharata, a number of such kings and emperors are mentioned, and also great sages are mentioned in the entire Puranic literature, who combined in their life the secular efficiency, the kingly efficiency, and the sagely quietitude or contemplative nature of great sages. So I've just tried to give you just a bird view of some of the fundamental scriptures of Hindu tradition. And I shall say a few more words about the Bhagavata Purana and its place in Hindu canonical literature, we are going to discuss this subject in detail tomorrow. As I said, you know, Puranas are half mythological. There is nothing much historical about it. But behind all these mythological stories and allegories and metaphors, there are great spiritual truths which are expounded, which are the connecting thread behind all these stories. These Puranas are altogether 36 in number. 18 great Puranas called Mahapuranas, and 18 Upapuranas, which are called secondary Puranas. The first category is the category of Mahapuranas, or the great mythological books. And the second category are the 18 Upapuranas, secondary. So 18 plus 18, altogether 36 great mythological books are found. Of these 18 Mahapuranas, or important Puranas, Bhagavata Purana has got a special importance, as I said earlier, because among the devotees, it is revered it is respected and considered to be authentic as much as the Vedas or Upanishads themselves. Because Upanishads do not speak to you directly. They expound certain subtle, universal, fundamental, spiritual, philosophical truths. But Bhagavata Purana tells you what you must do in this life now. How you can combine spirituality with your day-to-day activities, whether you are an housewife, whether you are a professional, whether you are a farmer, you are an IT man, whoever may be, a scientist, whoever may be, you are a farmer, anybody who lives in this world, whatever may be the profession, whatever religious tradition he may follow, can practice spirituality, can combine spirituality with their day-to-day duties and responsibilities. This important subject is discussed in great detail in the Bhagavata Purana. So it doesn't just give you a number of instructions and ideas, and it doesn't just present a great number of philosophical truths, but rather it tells you what you must do in this life, in the midst of all your day-to-day activities, duties and responsibilities, how we can combine spiritual activities, spiritual ideas along with our day-to-day struggles and responsibilities. How can spiritualize our day-to-day duties and responsibilities, whatever may be. How we can just make the secular merge with the spiritual. How we can spiritualize the secular life that we are living. How we can spiritualize the secular. This is the vital uniqueness of Bhagavata as a spiritual literature, and it is considered to be the most important devotional classic by the Vaishnavas, by the devotees who follow the path of Lord Mahavishnu, Lord Sri Krishna, because it is very direct, and it addresses the hearts and souls of devotees, no matter what profession they are practicing. They may not necessarily be living in the forest and doing meditation and worship and prayer, being engaged in prayer all the time. They may be busy in their household duties and responsibilities. Still, in the midst of all this, they can spiritualize their whole life and convert their whole scheme into a spiritual sadhana, so that every act becomes an act of worship. Every moment becomes an act of meditation. The whole world becomes a temple. Whole life becomes spiritual, and the secular merges with the spiritual. In fact, that is the uniqueness of Bhagavata Purana as a devotion classic, which we are going to deal with tomorrow in greater detail. Thank you. Namaskar.
Respected Shamajis, devotees, friends, we were listening for the last 1 hour completely the excellent way that our Shamaji, Shamatatamayanandaji, was explaining the scriptures of Hinduism, Sanatana Dharma. Actually, it is a picture of culture when the human society is slowly progressing. They are progressing only materialistically. At the same time, they are progressing culturally also. And what is that culture, the highest culture? Religion. And that's way, slowly, excellent way, he has given the picture of the scriptures. It is only the development of the human being. So next coming and tomorrow, Saturday, whole day, he'll be discussing about this, and also the first half of Sunday. And he'll be also addressing at the Levant Hindu temple, the devotees over there. So we welcome him, and also welcome you all. Please come tomorrow and come with your friends and relatives to you. Thank you very much. I'm so happy that you have come in such a great number. and listened with great attention. And slowly, I really wish that our younger generation should come. Because the moment they are listening, that is the time they are learning. And it is not that we are teaching them the chemistry, physics or any other things. We are teaching them how to live. After all those things, how they will live? And if they are living in pain, we are also in pain. So what is the fun of learning so much? So much of advancement in chemistry, so much of advancement in science, so much of advancement. But we don't know how to live. See, only in 2-3 sentences, how he said, and so much importance was given in almost 6,000 to 7,000 years before on the human life. Materialistic development will automatically come. But unless and until we know how to live within, how will we live? How will we survive? Every day when you are going back to bed, if you have to take the injection or the tablet to sleep, is this alive? So that are the questions we have to put before our younger generation. They are very intelligent and they are not going to accept anything without judgment. And that is the things that is there hidden in our scriptures. Accept, never accept it, judge it. But before judging, you must listen. And listen from the authorities. So these are the things. Please tell your younger people also to come and tell them. You need not to bother about the puja or anything. We will never tell them to fast. We will never tell them to follow anything of religion. Only listen. Just as you go in the college, university, listen, learn. Similarly, come over here. And that is the speciality of the Ramakrishna Mission. It's the speciality of the Vedanta society. So when a person is coming and when he is going back, is a different person. But that is the thing. Thank you very much. Come again tomorrow. We'll meet tomorrow again. Thank you, Swamiji.